Survive 17 days trapped in the rubble of a collapsed clothing factory in Bangladesh. 19-year-old seamstress Reshma Begum is recovering in hospital. She spent more than 2 weeks in temperatures in the mid-30s, surviving on dried food and bottles of water that she found in the rubble. From her hospital bed, she's spoken to Samoy TV.
It was very difficult to make myself heard. I kept banging whatever I could with my legs, but no one could hear me.
More than 1,000 people died in the disaster. The man accused of murdering Tia Sharp wrote to his father from prison, begging for his forgiveness and claiming her death was an accident. Stuart Hazel denies murdering the 12-year-old in South London last year. Prosecutors claim he sexually assaulted Tia before killing her and hiding her body in her grandmother's loft. Our crime correspondent Martin Brunt is reading an extract from Hazel's note.
God, I hate myself. I should have gone about this a different way, told the police everything. They're trying to say it was sexual, but I promise you, it wasn't.
A couple who filled their home full of junk have been given suspended sentences for child cruelty. The couple from Bedfordshire pleaded guilty to four charges in what's thought to be the first prosecution for hoarding. A British Olympic hero killed in a yachting accident has been described as a true inspiration and a sailing legend by his colleagues. Andrew Simpson died when his catamaran capsized during a training run ahead of the America's Cup. And Prince Harry has honoured America's war dead with a floral tribute at the Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia. He also left a bouquet of flowers at the grave of former President John F. Kennedy, who was assassinated almost 50 years ago in November 1963. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
From July this year, there will be a cap placed upon the maximum amount of benefit that claimants can receive. To find out more about these changes and to see if you will be affected, please see our webpages at www.bristol.gov.uk/benefits-changes.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. And helping us review this week's news is the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Stoke Bishop Peter Abraham. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, how secure is Bristol's food supply? Britain managed to feed itself just during World War II, but with about 15 million more mouths to feed, could we do it now? Somerset farmer and the man behind Puxton Park, Derek Mead, is here to give a farmer's eye view of us city dwellers. Plus, the man who helped arms firm BAE System to close the airfield, Filton Tory MP Jack Lopresti's recent all-expenses-paid trip to see the human rights-abusing dictators of Saudi Arabia. And he wasn't there to sell ice cream either. We talked to an expert on the evils of the international arms trade. Plus, June's secret meeting of the NATO's own mafia elite in Hertfordshire. We hear from a journalist that dared to ask a question or two at a previous get-together of the cartel of cartels, the Bilderberg Group. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 Celsius, a little rain this weekend, highs of 12, fairly drizzly and wet on Saturday, but sunnier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, sunshine and showers during the week. Next weekend, that's the 18th and 19th of May, highs down to 10 Celsius and fairly wet. So if you want to get out, do it on Sunday, this weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council and Councillor for Stoke, Bishop Peter Abraham. Peter, welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
First of all, Peter, how's things going with the politics of the city after the local elections? Have you any news for us on whether the Labour group are likely to join this administration or not with Mayor Ferguson?
I think the hot money is on them joining the group, the cabinet. But I think they're putting out some conditions at the moment, and George is not agreeing to them. So we've got to wait and see what happens.
I guess we'll have one of these long negotiated periods, like, for example, in Italy, you know, weeks, months go on and they still don't have a government together.
This isn't a question of not having a government. You have a government, you've got the mayor, and you have a cabinet, and they met this afternoon without the Labour group members being present, because they haven't named anybody yet, and that will continue. What the Labour group, I understand, are wanting is voting rights for cabinet members. That sounds, on the surface, well, not too heavy, but in actual fact, that would put us back exactly where we were, with individuals having the right to vote on each piece of policy and being able to vote down the mayor. The people of Bristol decided on a mayor because they wanted to get on with things and they didn't want decisions made in that way. So we support the mayor by saying very clearly, we don't believe voting rights under a mayoral system is appropriate.
I mean, surely it's better to have a group decision made rather than just one person, because that's almost like a dictatorship.
But that is what the people of Bristol decided. That was very, very clear. And it doesn't mean to say that there isn't a voting. I understand today, for instance, the cabinet met and there was most certainly disagreement within it, and indications that two members of the cabinet would be voting against some proposals at the cabinet meeting to be held, or indicating they were against it. So no problem there. What we have at the end of the day is the mayor who listens, takes his soundings, and then makes the decisions. In my words, gets on with the job.
So how does it work in your Conservative group? You've got Jeff Gollop in the cabinet, you've got yourself as the leader of the party. Who's actually running things, or is he just your ambassador?
I think he's not my ambassador, he's the group's ambassador most certainly, but he's there to also look after the interests of the whole of Bristol. We decided that we would cooperate with the mayor. That doesn't mean to say that we agree with everything he wants to do, that isn't the case, but we're there as a critical friend and we're there to get on and do the job. I repeat myself because I think that's important. The criticism has been Bristol have taken too long to make decisions. They don't live up to what the people of Bristol have wanted, and they've seen petty party squabbling, and this is what we're getting this weekend again, and hopefully it'll stop and we'll get on with it.
Now, you didn't do very well as a party nationally in the local elections, Peter. We had Tories lost 10 local authorities and 273 seats across the country. In the local elections, UKIP gained 120 seats, so not looking good. Although you managed to, there wasn't a lot of the Conservatives in marginal seats just in the local elections exposed this time. It was the Liberal Democrats that took the hits in the city. But what are your thoughts about the national picture? It seems there are many voters out there who are starting to be very discontented with David Cameron as a leader, as a national leader, doing things like beginning the process of privatising the National Health Service, something he actually said he wouldn't do before the election. And many people see the Conservatives as this millionaire's cabinet, as the nasty party that just uses power to grab more for themselves.
Well, that's a lot, isn't it? Let's start with where you began. The Tories didn't do very well. Well, that wasn't the case in Bristol, of course.
No, well, I was talking
and
about
national, but let's. I'm here. I can't represent national. I'm a Bristolian, and you've known me for a long time. And I bat for Bristol, and I don't care whether it's Tory, Labour, Liberal Democrat, or UKIP policy. If it's good for Bristol, I'm going to back it. And we, and my style of leadership, got quite an endorsement. We actually have got 14 seats where we were before. We didn't lose as our overall numbers. And we were in single figures of two others. We could have gone up to 16. We had one of the best results in the country. So we didn't do too bad, and people have liked our style, if you like. Now, nationally, you come into the UKIP intervention that took about 25%. I think you have to be honest about why they took that 25%. A number of reasons. We're midterm. We are taking some unpopular things as a Tory party. I think some of those things have got to be done. The cuts. Obviously, nobody wants a cut. We don't. I don't. But I believe it's essential, and I believe that local government and national government have got to get the book straight. That needed to be done. But this 25% was also the worrying 25% of those people who were campaigning against the European community because of its immigration policy. And that I don't go along with. I love living in Bristol in the multicultural city it is. And I think that we've got to look at how people come in, illegal immigrants and all the rest of it. But I'm not for this UKIP style, because when you scratch the real UKIP members and what they're saying some pretty racist things, you know, and I won't go along with that.
But isn't it the fact of the matter that immigration, not just under the present government, but under the previous New Labour government, has been allowed to increase and increase over really decades now, to drive down wages? And that's what this has been driven by. It's not driven by racism. It's driven by the fact that many of the pay and conditions that people have been learned to fight for really since the Second World War are now being eroded by mass immigration, eroding their pay and conditions, making it more and more difficult for people to make ends meet because there's someone that's going to come in, take their job and undercut them.
I'm not totally convinced that's true. That you see, we have a situation, don't we, where we have the minimum pay in this country, and we've also got the work directive. Now, it's where you sit, you see. Workers or trade unions will say, we don't like that directive, or we like that directive, I should say. Employers say they don't like it because it lessens employment. So you have a dilemma of what is right and what is wrong. I think that, that we do see some of the population changing, and people are long-term worried about that. I think they're also worried about the influx that might be taking place later in this year and next year. I got a feeling that we've got to get this all in perspective. I want to see higher wages. I've never believed in low wages. I was an employer for many years, and I knew the more I paid, the better I got. In actual fact, at the end of the day, the more money I make because I got better employees.
Yes, but since this coalition government's come in, we've had something like 15% erosion of living standards. That is to say that the bills that we're having to pay are going up much faster than wages. Some people, of course, having to take pay cuts.
Basically, whatever you earn, we've had that 15% cut. Of course, if you're on the lower pay, that's going to be much more dramatic than if you're earning more. But people are struggling out there. And why are we struggling? It's because when the Conservative coalition with the Liberals took over, the country was bankrupt. And we can't ignore this. Now, you either go on and borrow more money, and you don't try to cut out the welfare bill, which I think needs to be looked at how we do it, and cut the other things, expenditures in local government. Do you know, a lot of the cuts in local government, you'd find hard to tell me how they've affected. And we're now saving millions compared with what we were spending a few years ago. So there was a need to have a look at this and bring, if you like, government expenditure, both local and national, down. And that cannot be done without hurting.
Well, you're saying that ultimately that this policy of cutting and the austerity is going to succeed eventually in turning the economics round, repaying these debts. I put it to you that there's absolutely no chance of that, Peter. If you look at the amount that the debt is increasing, the national debt at the moment, we're in a debt spiral. We're never going to be able to pay that off because if you look at all we're managing to do is to slightly decrease the massive increase every year in the national debt. We're actually not putting a dent in it at all.
I don't accept that at all. I do believe we can succeed. I would be here telling you that it's got to be changed if I didn't believe it. I believe it's a simple matter of, as a nation, we were spending too much of public money, and we were demanding through that higher and higher taxes, whether it be through income tax or sales tax or whatever it may be, in order to pay it. And the people that affects is down the bottom of the list as far as pay is concerned, because that hurts them more. And I worry about young people today and the bills they have to pay. And I think we've got a duty to try to get this straight. And I see no evidence that it's not going to work. In actual fact, I believe passionately that by getting working through this, that it very soon we will start to see an upturn in our economy and things will look considerably brighter.
But let's look at the figures. 800 billion was the debt when the coalition government came in. We're now heading up to 1.4 trillion. You actually not managed to turn it around at all. And it doesn't look as if we're going to do that, because we're going to be almost double the national debt by the end of this government.
But what is the other suggestion? Borrow more?
Well, this is the other suggestion is, well, okay, we've got old Labour Oxford economist Martin
Absolutely.
Summers. Not being an economist myself, we'll ask him to come in with any other options, Martin.
Well, I think it's interesting because the Chancellor George Osborne, you know, dared Ed Balls, and he said they want to borrow less by borrowing more. And that sounds plausible. But in actual fact, that is what you have to do in a situation like this, as senior US economists are saying, like Krugman, Stiglitz and people like that. You
do, Martin, we're heading for 1.4 trillion debt.
Yes.
There's absolutely no way we're going to pay back the money that we have used to bail out the banks in 2008.
Well, the real problem that we're facing, I'm afraid, the rosy picture of what's happening in the British and the international...
And that was under New Labour, yeah?
Yes, I'm not denying that. I'm trying to have a high-level discussion about this rather than a Yabu sucks discussion. The problem is that the last 3 years of a cutting public expenditure, in my view, were wrong. I mean, the reason why public expenditure went up is because the banks went bust and had to be bailed out. So that's the fundamental reason why it all shot out of control. The debt to GDP ratio continues to rise because GDP is being suppressed by the cuts, effectively. The debt in relation to GDP continues to go up, which is why the ratings agencies have started to grumble and say that we're going to downgrade Britain's credit rating, which of course was the basis for the whole policy, was that the ratings agencies would in fact keep Britain's credit rating. When Nick Clegg came to Bristol just after the election, I interviewed him for this programme. I said, but you know what's going to happen 3 years in? You're going to lose the country's credit rating and you're going to lose a large chunk of GDP. And of course, when you lose GDP, what we're talking about is people losing their jobs, losing their foothold, losing their security. Ultimately, I think what will happen, I'm afraid, is that the banks will collapse, and New Labour and the Labour leadership aren't really being honest to the people about this. The banks are still bankrupt. The euro crisis banking crisis in the city of
London. The banks keep up making up more money to lend out to keep the economy going.
No, they keep
going.
Up making up money to pretend to be solvent. They're not, in fact, solvent. And they're now talking about selling off RBS and Lloyds at less than the taxpayer paid for them, at a loss of billions to the taxpayer. Now, this, of course, this is the nub of the argument about whether you should or should not cut in this situation. When Oliver Blanchard, who's the head of the IMF, who was in here last week, and the IMF generally call for cuts. That's their usual mantra. And they're saying, it's time to change course because in actual fact you've overdone it. And this is of course what the Labour front bench have been saying all along. It's difficult to explain to people that in actual fact cutting public expenditure leads to increases in public expenditure, but that's...
Well, you just had your chance to explain. Peter, what about this idea of a plan B? Do you think George Osborne should be making sure that he's got a plan B in case he doesn't turn things around?
Any government should always have a plan B. Dogmatic governments are normally bad governments, and therefore I think it right to have a look at it. But for every person that I find that says the government are doing it wrong and should do it the other way, there's some other expert that will tell me, steady on, keep going. I mean, we aren't just dealing with the British economy, are we? We are in a world situation, and I believe that if we as a country can get ourselves managing our own economy, and that actually means, whether you like it or not, as public services, we were spending too much. Whatever the banking situation, I genuinely believe for a long time that we were spending too much. So I think it's a very good idea that we cut that down. I think that will put us in a better position. Now, if it is found, and the people that really know about this, and I don't, say to the government and say to the public, look, we really have got to find a different way, I hope that George Osborne, David Cameron, will be man enough to say, let's do it. But I don't hear that being said, and I don't see the evidence
for
it.
Well, maybe you weren't down at Castle Park last Saturday, because that's our first story this week. Campaigners marching through Bristol to protest against the cuts.
So they know the answer, do they? Come on.
Anti-cuts campaigner.
Let's be real.
Anti-cuts campaign has led a May Day march through the centre of Bristol. Yeah. Bristol Trades Council spearheaded the demonstration last Saturday, which started at College Green, snaked through the city centre
anyway.
To Castle Park. Well, this is the trade unions that you were talking about earlier on, who have a far greater membership, of course, than our political parties. So let's have a listen to one of the speeches. This is Jane Taylor from Unite.
Thank you, comrades. Yesterday was a great day for my branch. When John Rogers privatised our home care service, we told him we'd come for him. We told him we'd come for him politically, and we got him. Bye-bye, John Rogers. Bye-bye, John Keeley, and bye-bye, Steve Comer. We'll miss you. And Unite have a message for the Labour group. Please do not get into bed with this Mayor's Cabinet. If you lie down with dogs, you will get up with fleas. Thank you for all coming to this demonstration. You are showing the strength of feeling that's mirrored up and down this country today. There can be no doubt that this government are carrying out a systematic attack upon our class, worse than anything Thatcher could have dreamt of. Living standards have been reduced by keeping wages low to maximise profits. Disabled people are forced back to work and the rich receive tax breaks while we feed on horse meat. Everything is up for grabs. Pensions, wages, benefits and now spare rooms. Austerity cuts have made it increasingly difficult for people to meet everyday expenditure on life's basic needs such as food, energy and housing. With less money in the local economy, it is no wonder that jobs and growth have stalled as a result of the government's strangling demand and shops on our high street are closing at an alarming rate. This town is now witnessing the closure of care homes, food banks appearing on our streets, drastic cuts to youth services that will affect employment and the families that rely upon these services. And now it is the intention to tax people who have the temerity to live in a house with room to walk around in. The irony is that all of this is proposed by a class of people who would get claustrophobic in a house measuring less than 3,000 square feet and run into blind panic if there wasn't a wine cellar. The welfare minister introducing this measure owns an 8-bedroom mansion, yet he proposes a reduction in housing benefit of 14% if claimants live in a property with one spare room. And while he sits back in comfort, he suggests people move into smaller properties in the private sector, properties that don't exist. He even suggests how our children should sleep. The UK has a chronic housing shortage brought about by the lack of investment and over-reliance on the private sector during the last 30 years. The answer to this is not a tax upon the poor, but to reinvigorate our economy by building affordable homes. And more importantly, a commitment to a major council house building programme. It is a sick system that can allow construction workers to remain idle while the whole country is crying out for new homes to be built. So we need to stand together, pool our resources into one and fight every attack upon our class, both young and old, and demand decent care for the elderly, youth services to remain intact, and disabled people's services, no eviction for arrears, and to make the implementation of the bedroom tax impossible through appeals and a political fight they have not witnessed since we made them scrap the poll tax. Make sure your children have a society worth living in. Stay together, fight together and win together, comrades. Thank you.
Yes, that was Jane Taylor there from Unite the Union at Castle Park last Saturday, just the day after the local election results. Now, were you down there, Peter Abraham, leader of the Conservative group?
I tend listening to that. Wish I had been, because it really... the first thing that struck me of the whole of that left-wing rhetoric was there was not one solution, and there was total exaggeration. Drastic cuts in the youth service. Could we hear about those, please? Because we put more money in the youth service this year in our budget. The Tories did. Conservative group did. That's what we did. and supported by the rest of the council. Maximise profits. I talk to a lot of small business people in this city and they're not doing it so well. Maximise profits. And then there's attack on the Labour group themselves with the silly business of sleep with dogs and you get fleas.
Well, it wasn't actually an attack on the group, was it? It was saying to them that they don't think, you know,
join the cabinet. Yes. Was if that an attack on the group? What is?
Well, there are people within the group that think that.
Very, very nasty. They can't, you know, goodbye John Rogers, goodbye John Keely. I don't have a brief for them, either of them politically. But I know John Rogers quite well. He actually was my doctor for many years. And I know he's a good man. It was doing his best, as I say, politically, not for me. But I mean, why treat somebody like that who'd given some years of public service?
But isn't that, democracy, Peter? Peter,
it is
democracy because he was involved in the private... He was involved in the privatisation of home care, wasn't he? And, and if he's going to do something like that, if his voters may not go for him.
These people on as the experts in answer to me. You said, well, here's some of the answers. They did a march for cuts. Play it back and listen to what you said. Because that's it. I didn't learn anything from that. All I learned was a bunch of people who just want to have a go for having a go. Now, I would respect them more if they come forward and give us some solutions. I am desperately worried about the number of houses being built that young people can't get. And all this business about wine cellars and all the rest of it. Where does that take us forward? That just seems to be nasty for nasty's sake. And I don't think it goes down well and I don't think it achieves anything. There are problems. I want to see more spent on the youth service. I want to see good youth service. I am elderly, so I obviously want to see good care for the elderly. But every pound that we spend on the elderly has got to be earned by the workers. And that's the younger people. So you've got to be careful what you're saying and what you're doing.
Okay, Martin, what was your reaction to that speech from Jane Taylor and Unite there last weekend at Castle Park? And could you maybe, react to what Peter's saying there? Because it does seem like a bit of a rant. That they're saying, you know, not enough food is too expensive, energy is too expensive, not enough housing, but the solutions aren't there in the speech.
All right, well, I mean, I think the one solution that was mentioned, and Peter picked up on this, is housing as an issue which can unite us.
Absolutely.
And I think I'm agnostic about whether the Labour group should or shouldn't join the cabinet. It's a decision for those concerned, and I will support whatever is decided.
I agree with you entirely.
But, of course, if we do join the Cabinet, or the Labour Party joins the Cabinet, I mean, there's been discussions with George Ferguson and with Jeff from the Conservative Party about Bristol, you know, being serious about doing something about housing for people on low incomes. And I think that is actually consensus in Bristol. There's an understanding that that's an issue that's got to be addressed. But of course, what she's also saying is she's not actually a full-time union official. She's the elected representative inside the council for Unite. She's actually a homeless, works with homeless people, I believe. On a national level, I think even within the Conservative Party, there are voices saying, well, perhaps we ought to think in terms of investing in things like housing as part of the solution or the plan B, which is evolving, if you like. And I think I never believed that the policy being pursued by the coalition was going to work. I mean, I basically said to Nick Clegg when he came here, as I said earlier, that it was probably going to play out exactly like this. I put it to Peter that we've actually tried the cut solution and it's not working, and that sometime in the near future, especially if the euro crisis continues to intensify or the Americans start turning down, as they may well do, we may have to, all of us, think in a different way. Because in any case, the deficit will continue to go up, because that's what happens in a crisis. That's what happened in the 1980s, and it's more than likely to happen.
Well, there is a bit of good economic news this week. The mayor, go on, Peter.
I was just going to say one thing on this housing, because I think this is a critical issue. Well, I had some talks with some of the leading people on the property board yesterday. There's a lot of land in public ownership in this city, and I think we ought to be looking to releasing that. I've been looking at self-build. And it doesn't mean to say you've got to put the bricks and mortar up yourself, but if your clerk of works, you can put your Zusa house for about half the cost. This might well be a way. And if we could give the land or loan it to people to start with, I think we could start. I think it needs some real measures, thinking outside the box, and really trying to do something, because I got a feeling that one thing that Jane said was right, was that would genuinely help employment, because it's the sort of jobs, you know, brickies and all the rest of it, plumbers, that we could get it. And so I applaud that, and I go along. And just finally, if we've got to change the way we're doing it in order to get it right, so be it. I'm not going to see this country go down for dogmatic reasons, and I'll be up there protesting with David Cameron that that's what we should be doing. If there's evidence enough to say that this is not working, we've got to look at different ways.
Well, one of the things that is happening successful economically, at least on one level, the mayor has officially opened a new hub for start-up firms this week. This was in the Bristol Post. Mm-hmm. Mike Ribbeck writing on Thursday, the company behind a new business centre in the heart of Bristol has revealed plans to build a new office block, shop and hotel close to Temple Mead Station. Temple Studios, right in the heart of the new enterprise zone, is officially opened by the city's mayor, George Ferguson, yesterday. The £7 million centre had been developed by property firm TCN UK, was designed as a creative hub for start-up businesses. High hopes that a new 12,000 all-seater indoor arena will be built on land near Temple Mead Station 2 at the former diesel depot site. Well, a lot of emphasis on office space and this kind of thing, but not housing so far. Anyway, let's have a little listen to...
There is a shortfall in office, and of course it does create jobs.
Well, let's have a listen to Robin Markwell speaking to George Ferguson on Radio Bristol earlier this week.
Yeah, we've had the tour, we've seen photography studios, we've seen marketing agencies, design agencies. It's very cutting edge. You wanted it as part of your media mile here, but hey, is there a risk of a glut of office space in Bristol? Because we've got offices in central Bristol that letting agents simply can't shift.
Well, because it's boring, dreadful office space, some of it. I mean, what's important is that we provide the sort of office space that people want, and I think here we're getting workspace, I like to call it, rather than office space. It's creative space, and I think office space is that dreadful standard surveyor spec offices that were really driven by the funds who wanted to play safe. I think now it's safer to be more daring.
Well, daring or not, this is part of the... Actually, I mean, one of the things, there's a website out there called Speak Truth to Power, which is done by a guy called Tony Crofts in Bristol, Peter. He regularly, once a month, phones round the various estate agents to find out how much empty office space there is. So I'm going to contradict you. According to him, we've got 60 acres, that is floor space, of empty offices at the moment. That's 2 million square feet of empty office space in Bristol. And he's worked out that that is equivalent to over 2,000 two-bed homes. Obviously, an office is not... You can't live in it. But if you could convert it, as many, you know, many ex-industrial areas have been, to housing, you would get 2,000 homes out of that empty office space. So why are we building more offices, this place in the enterprise zone, for example, when we've got 2 million square feet of empty office space already?
I thought George actually addressed that very well. You have to face the fact that today office space needs to be completely different. Many of our old offices are not suitable for modern IT. So you're a businessman going, or woman going along, you look at that office space and it blatantly isn't suitable. And so what we want is more workspace, stroke office space within the central areas, and there is a shortage of that.
So is it nothing now, to do with the rent then?
It could be to do with the rent. I don't know. I haven't analysed that.
There doesn't seem to be a free market, does there? Because if there were, people with empty offices would drop the rent until new start-up businesses, people with less money, could come in and use them.
No, I don't. It's probably they are cheap, but you don't. If the office is not good enough to work in and you can't bring in your IT that you want to, then it's just a very high rent to you because it's not useful. What we should be doing is looking at those offices that have now passed their usefulness and returning them. I mean, there was the office on the city centre, blatantly there, wasn't there? Bristol and West. Outlived its usefulness, no longer any good for it. It's hotel now and got bedrooms in it. I would like to, as I said earlier, I would like to see us free up some of the land and start building some houses. And if people saw the housing market is profitable, I cannot believe that these entrepreneurs wouldn't move in and do it.
Martin, why is it that we're building offices? We just heard that this new one opening this week, even though there's 60 acres of empty office space, we're building more offices, but we're not building more houses.
Well, it's basically the system has been set up for a generation to oversupply offices, which will go on the books of banks as assets, and of course that's underpinning the banks' the bank's so-called viability, and we haven't, under New Labour as well as under our previous governments, done enough for social housing for people on low incomes. And I think New Labour had 13 years in power, and they just decided they would just leave that to the private sector, and that was wrong. A previous generation of Conservative governments wouldn't have done that. The most investment in social housing in Britain was during the Macmillan era in the 1950s, and the Conservatives have got in the past had a good
now?
Record on
what
this.
About now? Why aren't we building houses now, social housing?
Because we've decided to put all our horses on all our money on one horse, the private sector, and George Osborne's attempt to kind of kickstart the private sector by providing subsidies and backup for people to buy houses. In order to
would it be too bland to say if someone is going in doing stuff in an office, they're actually generating cash, they're all taxable, and therefore there's an incentive for the government to be providing that office space because people in there are generating economic activity.
We've patently got more office space than we need. There's been an oversupply of office space because, as George Ferguson said, it was the easy option for people thinking about projects. The city will lend for it. The office space will go on the books as, and that's one of the reasons why they're not rented out at a lower rate. Because if they rent it out at a lower rate, the actual value of the office goes down to the point, and that means that the bank or whoever it is that owns it is then undermined. And this, of course, is the problem with property bubbles all along. And in the 1950s, for example, when Macmillan was in power and on into the 60s and the 70s, there was an understanding that if you allow the private property market to bubble, it will just bubble and crash.
So what's going
to
happen?
You've got to have another leg to your policy, which is government or local government provision of social housing, for example, or council housing, as we used to call it back in the day.
But by allowing extra loans for people to buy houses in the budget, Osborne's just pumping that bubble up.
Yeah, but what he's trying to do is restart the housing bubble. I would argue we don't need any more housing bubbles. I mean, house prices in Germany haven't budged much in 40 years, and that's what you really want. You don't want people making money on their houses. You want them making money by producing new stuff and coming up with new ideas.
You are a victim, aren't you, sometimes? I mean, I was never in favour of the way that we sold council houses. Tory policy, thought to be right, and I think it was right as a person that lived in a council house. Well, my mum and dad had a council house, and they wanted to buy it. It was their home, you know, and I think it was right. What was wrong was that we took the money away from the local authorities. The government grabbed back, I think it was half of it, if my memory serves me right. What it should have been is you sell that house and you use that money to build another. Because what you were doing is you were diminishing the stock overnight of affordable houses, and it was right and proper, I think, as I say, for people to buy, but there was no reason, and it would have regenerated the people being able to buy. So here's a bit of right policy at the beginning that goes horribly wrong that we're actually paying for today. And there is evidence, isn't there, out there now. Experts will say to young people, don't buy, you're probably better to rent. So there is a rented market out there available.
But surely the bottom line, Peter, here is that these offices are being built because this government favours business. It doesn't really care about poor people that need housing.
I wish the government had that much control. This is business in what they wanted it. I mean, part of that Temple Meads thing, the BBC are building houses, building offices down there, aren't they? They're going to move down there, and they're going to have studios there. And now that has been a terrible part of Bristol. They needed tidying up and clearing up.
Okay, well, we will.
So there's some good coming.
We will be revisiting this subject, no doubt, about why offices get built and not affordable housing in the future. But next story, this is the Queen's speech this week. What was in and what was left out? So let's have a little listen now to not only Her Majesty but also the Beast of Bolsover.
Royal Mail for sale, Queen's Head privatised.
My Lords and Members of the House of Commons, my government's legislative programme will continue to focus on building a stronger economy so that the United Kingdom can compete and succeed in the world. It will also work to promote a fairer society that rewards people who work hard. My government will continue to make the case for Scotland to remain part of the United Kingdom. My government will ensure the security, good governance and development of the overseas territories, including by protecting the Falkland Islanders and Gibraltarians' right to determine their political futures.
Well, that was Her Majesty, followed by... Dennis Skinner, Beast of Bolsover, followed by Her Majesty. I'm just going to ask you about, Peter, about the sort of pomp side of this, because looking at the thing on the TV on Wednesday, I was just thinking this is a kind of relic of a dying empire. It's lots and lots of pomp, but actually it's only a tiny little speech, and what's missing from that speech is really some of the most important stuff. For example, we've had this constant promise before the election and since that David Cameron is going to introduce a register of lobbyists, because lobbying is one of the biggest problems in central government, where you've got big companies coming along and twisting the arms of ministers, getting them to do what they want rather than what the people want day after day, where we only get a chance to elect them once every 4 years. So what are your thoughts about whether it really means anything, the pomp of the state opening?
I can't see the connection between the two. The pomp is there because that's the way we do it in this country, and the majority of people think we do it rather well. I think it also starts off in the proper way by symbolising something I'm a great supporter of, and that is the Queen might not have any power, but she stops the politicians having the ultimate power. So I think that puts her finger on the main lines of policy. And we know that the Queen's speech does not include everything, but it is written for her, it's not written by her. So it is her government, our government, their programme, so say, for the next year. And we can criticise that. I would be sad to see that involvement go, because I think what it would mean would be the Prime Minister just getting up and saying, this is the programme, where I like it that our head of state is saying this is the programme.
Well, you say the Queen doesn't have any power, but of course she does, for example, phone up ministers, as we heard last year, to say, why hasn't this Abu Hamza been arrested yet? Why can't you find something to arrest him for? This kind of thing. So obviously she...
Well, that's not power,
is it? The other thing is she's appointing...
It's influence.
She's appointing Lord Lieutenants around the country. She's
not power.
She's influential
and that
in other ways. So is she really just a figurehead?
But
no power,
really
no power at all.
You don't really believe that appointing Lord Lieutenants around the country is power. Lord Lieutenant sits and goes out and opens the odd thing and receives the royalty when they come into the city. It's not power.
She also
does.
They
have influence. I accept they have great influence, but I don't accept that she has power.
She also managed, I don't know how, but she's managed to increase her wages by about £5 million this year. So she must be able to twist somebody's arm. I mean, she's already incredibly wealthy, owns more land than almost anybody else on the planet, and obviously taking that in. So she's got some influence.
Jane Taylor should be talking to her, because the Queen's style is obviously get more successful than Jane in Unite does.
Okay, Martin, what about the Queen's speech and all the pomp? Does it really mean anything?
Well, I mean, at some point we may in the future decide to rejig the way we do things in the country. I mean, for example, if Scotland votes for independence, that will change the game,
true.
For example. I mean, and of course, in Northern Ireland, there's been this whole idea of parity of esteem between the two communities. So one side of the community supports the Queen, the other side doesn't, but they've found a way to live with that. And that's what we do in this country. We bodge as we go forward. And it looks a bit messy, but that bodging is actually, you know, the product of a lot of negotiation over the centuries.
So why is there nothing in there about lobbying, Peter? Because lobbying is one of the biggest, I mean, quite regularly identified as one of the biggest problems in government, where people are paid to influence politicians day after day, week after week, where we only get a chance once every 4 years.
I don't know, is the honest answer. I haven't any power at all, and obviously I haven't got any influence. It's not an area I've ever
Let's take one example, which is the healthcare lobby. Many powerful, rich American companies and British companies are right now lobbying for, and have successfully lobbied for, changes to the way the health service is run by opening it up to competition from these private firms. That's something that's happened because of lobbying, and it was something which was David Cameron expressly promised before the general election that he would not do. So they've obviously got some power.
They have, or... is it that we've been unable to find a way of successfully curbing it? I mean, I don't know. It's back to the freedom of speech. I mean, I get lobbied every day from constituents. How would I stop that? I mean, I just think that if there's lobbying, they might find another way.
Let me clarify. Yeah. What he promised was that there should be a register of lobbyists, and so that everyone that was being paid to lobby, the company that was doing the lobbying. Well, why isn't it in the Queen's speech then?
I haven't got a clue.
Martin?
Transparency is my key word.
Well, I think that's the reason it isn't in is because the lobbyists have lobbied for it not to be in, and that is the bottom line, I'm
that's
afraid.
That's probably right.
And the money in politics is something we need to consider. I mean, in Scandinavian countries at the end of the Second World War, they realised that money and politics really were a bad mix. So in places like Norway, for example, all political parties are funded by the state, according to their support within the population, and that is the only money they get. And if you look in the US, of course, which is the other extreme, basically Wall Street funds every major political candidate and makes sure that they all sing to the same hymn sheet when they get elected, because there's no limit to the amount of money that can be spent. And recent rules put forward in the US means that nobody has to say where their money comes from. I would say that the minimum we should be asking for in this country is we need to know who is lobbying for what. And of course you could go further into the Scandinavian level, where we actually keep that money out altogether and just fund the political parties according to their level of support, but that's another step.
Okay, well,
would it be done in another way, though? That's what worries me. Just having this register, what does that actually solve?
Well, that's why the Scandinavians say the only funding for politics comes from the state, and that you can lobby.
And
you can lobby by
arguing,
but you can't pay. You can't pay to get your policy through.
And that, then we've got to start footing the bill for political parties, haven't we?
I suppose we have. But I mean, in Scandinavia, they took the view that was the price of democracy. And of course, also the price of running campaigns in places like Norway is a fraction of our price, because of course that the limit, you know, the everybody's capped to it within.
But it's a very low cap here. It's probably not appreciated. I've just fought an election in Stoke Bishop, 8,000 electors. I've got to print election addresses and deliver and all the rest of it, and I've got to have some office space and all the rest of it. My limit is £1,000, which is not a lot of money. I would say hardly enough to inform the electorate properly of what I stand for. I produced a newspaper and a small election address, and that takes me up to the limit.
Politics costs money.
Absolutely.
And of course, politicians, I was used to work with the Polish Socialist Party in Poland, and we had to go to a meeting once where these lobbyists wanted to build, they needed to see a minister quickly to get a permission to build a hotel on the Baltic, and the Polish Socialist Party was in the government at the time. So we went to the meeting, and we signed a deal with them that they would see the minister next week. We arranged it, and they said, there's a local election coming up. Oh yes, how much would you like? And the lobbyist said, do you want this payable to the party or to you personally? And we said, to the party, please. And we got the money. And then they said, when we've built the hotel, guys, you can have your congresses there and we can fix girls for you and all sorts. And we said, goodbye, your meeting's at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. But we needed that money to fight a local election. And so you end up getting, you went away afterwards thinking, I need a shower after talking.
Well, the temptation is, of course, for it to go in the pocket, isn't it?
Well, they presumed that we were just wanting the money personally to fix the meeting. Whereas actually, in fact, we needed the money for an election.
Well, some people that have been lobbying successfully, from whether within the Conservative Party or without, is not quite clear, is the probation service, because it looks like that's going to be privatised as part of this next session of Parliament. So, let's have a listen now to the Tory, Philip Davis, who has qualms about it, and then followed by Labour's Ian Lavery.
The figures from his department are perfectly clear that the longer people spend in prison, the less likely they are to re-offend, largely because it gives them the time to do things like teach people to read whilst they're in prison before they're released. So what weight is he putting to longer prison sentences to reduce re-offending? And the department is also very clear that the thing that had the lowest re-offending rate of all were indeterminate sentences for public protection. So given reducing re-offending is so important, why on earth have the government got rid of the one thing that had the lowest re-offending rate of all?
Why doesn't the Justice Secretary just admit it? Come clean. This isn't about re-offenders, it isn't about the general public, it's about the prize of privatisation and political dogma and ideology.
Well, that's Chris Grayling that's introducing this, the new Justice Secretary. And Peter, do you think it makes sense to privatise the probation service? We've had in the national news yesterday that Bristol has actually got one of the best probation services in the country, very, very, very successful at stopping reoffending. Why does it need to be privatised?
I think there is a cost involved, and I think that one does look at some of the expenditure and thinks that perhaps privatisation might be able to control that in a better way. I'm not convinced that the probation service over the country is as fit for purpose as one might make out, and there has been some real problems with it. One of the things I do worry about is that occasionally we have a service that we want to improve, and rightly so, and then we look of how we might be able to improve it, and then we fall back on partial privatisation or privatisation as the remedy. I'd want to know considerably more about how that's going to be done before I agreed, but I do think that there is a need to have a look at the probation service and reoffending, whether we've got one of the best in the country. I would suggest to you that it's still not good enough.
Martin, does it make sense to privatise probation?
Well, I think I agree with what Peter's saying. If the problem is with an ideological approach to this, if you've got a hammer in your hand, every problem looks like a nail. So, if, for example, the probation service is not up to scratch, privatisation is run out as the
but
answer.
We're hearing in Bristol, it's actually one of the best in the country. Well, it's doing a fantastic job. I mean, just a minute. It's doing a fantastic job in rehabilitating offenders. No, this is in the national news yesterday. Of the figures around the country, the Bristol Probation Service is doing an extremely good job. In fact, they came to Bristol to talk to some of the probation officers and the head of the probation service about how they've done what they've done.
But this isn't just about Bristol.
No, this is a national.
This is on a national. This is on a national scale.
I think we've got to look nationwide, and I think there's some real problems. I have some insight in some of the things, hostels and things like that that happen around the country, and by gosh, there's some problems.
Well, I mean, we're dealing with, you know, people who are offending and basically making trouble for the rest of the community. It's a tough one to deal with.
Absolutely.
For always going to be. There's a small minority that spoil it for everybody, and we all know that this is a major issue and has been from generation to generation. But I think, ultimately, things like prisons and so on, and things like the administration of justice, that has to be seen to be above private profit-taking, if you like. I mean, when I mentioned to Danish friends of mine that we had private prisons in Britain, they said, that's extraordinary, you know. Because, of course, if you've got private prisons, as you've got in the US, there was some guy who was sending people to prison because he had shares in the prison that he was sending them to. And that obviously is extreme. And, of course, if you want people to respect the law, it's got to be above that sort of thing. So when you lock somebody up for, you know, stealing from the community or making trouble for the community, it is the community's punishment. It's not a punishment by the rich or whatever, or somebody making a profit. There's something quite special about, you know, the law should be beyond that kind of corruption.
Okay, on to our next story. A lawyer for the victims of Jimmy Savile said a police report concluding that there is no evidence he was protected by police officers doesn't add up. This is the West Yorkshire Police report published today, found no evidence Jimmy Savile was protected from arrest or prosecution by his relationship with the West Yorkshire Police Force. The 59-page report examined the history of the DJ and the TV presenter's relationship with the force, including how officers attended his weekly Friday morning club at Jimmy Savile's Leeds flat. West Yorkshire Police said there were currently 76 crimes involving 68 victims committed in the West Yorkshire area relating to Savile, but none of these was reported to the force before his death. The youngest of these was 5 years old at the time, and eight others were aged nine or under. Well, before we hear your reaction to this report today, the latest in this Jimmy Savile saga, let's have a listen to what people out there on the streets think. This is what you think, and Marina Morris asks you. Who you think's to blame?
Jimmy Savile. Was the BBC monitoring adequate?
We should blame the BBC because they already knew the issue and they kind of cover it. It's an internal problem with the BBC who covered it and didn't tell us the truth from the beginning.
At the time, no, because I think they knew. I've seen the documentary about it, and I think they did know really what was going on. But I suppose there were cultural issues back then that nobody really spoke about it. But especially now, I think that the BBC put on that tribute over Christmas. Christmas when they knew then that there was issues with his conduct because of the Panorama documentary.
BBC have got a lot of the blame because from what I've read and heard in the press then, they were certainly aware of it, but perhaps didn't act. Jimmy Savile was almost put on a pedestal by the BBC. I think he seemed untouchable from what I understand in the press. Certainly was well aware of it.
You have to judge at the time, sort of the standards at the time. The standards at the time were very different, weren't they? So I think I'd have to know a bit more about more recently. I don't think that they've done a massively good job.
I think one of the problems at the time was probably that quite a lot of junior members of staff were aware of what was going on, and they were obviously afraid of speaking out and saying something.
There was definitely a cover-up with the BBC, definitely, and he obviously knew what he was doing was wrong, but he still kept on doing it. It's just disgusting. It really is. He's just absolutely horrible.
What should the BBC have done to Jimmy Savile?
They should have reported him to the police and let the proper authorities investigate and take the appropriate action.
They should have taken the complaints more seriously, probably, shouldn't they? They were coming from so many different people, and investigated it sooner rather than covering it up and putting out a tribute programme.
They should have told everybody the truth and make him redundant and take him to the justice, I think.
Well, they should have investigated the allegations, and if they found that they were true, sacked him.
Who is to blame? BBC? Police? Society?
The BBC, because the police can't act without the information, although I do understand they did have some information. Partly the police, but initially I'd say the BBC, because they're the ones that needed to report the allegations and let the police follow it up.
Mixture of all three.
And Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, he was the one who was abusing the children, so it's mainly him. But they're to blame in allowing perhaps there to be more victims than there would have been, because if they'd have acted on what they knew, which they all did know something, I think that's been shown. The police and the BBC both had an inkling, if nothing else, and by allowing him to continue as a BBC children's broadcaster, they gave him access to the very thing that he was abusing. So it's a combination, but ultimately the blame has to rest with Jimmy Savile.
I think we have to blame BBC in that case, because they were responsible for uncovering the issue.
Yes, and they didn't. And let's not forget also that the BBC presenter here in Bristol, Peter Rowell, was jailed last year in March for abusing girls. He admitted 12 charges of indecent assault on girls under the age of 16.
BBC Bristol.
That is the BBC Bristol. Peter, what are your thoughts on the Jimmy Savile business? And I mean, the idea that the police every morning, Friday morning, were round his flat having a chat with him every week.
If we can come up to date, the news this morning that there was police involvement, if you like, at that time, I found amazing statement. I was embarrassed by it.
Okay.
Because I'm a great supporter of the police and I want them to believe them, but I didn't believe them on this.
Martin.
Jimmy Savile was protected because he had friends in high places. He spent 11 New Year's Eves with Margaret Thatcher in her private residence at Chequers. When you've got those kind of friends, it's easy to make the police look the other way.
Okay, now, that's it. Coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, who is the leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Stoke Bishop Peter Abraham. After the news, how secure is Bristol's food supply?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award.